accession number 18523, Reel 2.
Ted Winkler, Reel 2.
The socialists and communists were actually at a hopeless end because the party had taken over completely. So quite a few of them became turncoats and joined the Nazi and Socialist Party and National Socialist Party.
And after the Second World War was declared, did the war affect you at first in any way, personally?
Not really. We were listening to the various reports and looks like until they started bombing Hamburg. That was something we hadn't anticipated.
But had the bombing of Hamburg started before you went to Poland?
Yes, it had started before. Small areas, you know. And in those days it was the industrial areas they attacked.
Did any bombs fall near your home?
Yes, they fell in my grandfather's house, which was not far away from where I lived. He was a professor at the university in Hamburg. He was a graphic printing and such like.
And when did the bombing start in Hamburg, do you remember?
I couldn't give you a date at the moment.
Did any bombs fall near your factory in Hamburg?
Yes, hit it once or twice inside, but that was later on.
After you left?
Yes, after I left. Because I came on leave and went there, and they're building the big aeroplane, the transport plane. And when I came into the firm and walked around, there was several planes had been slung into the roofs of the factory and such like, and they were big planes.
You mean thrown into the roof by the explosion?
By the bombing explosion, yeah. The whole place was in a mess.
But before you left Hamburg, was the bombing just light?
It was just light, I would call it, in comparison to what happened later on.
Were you at all frightened by the bombing?
Well, I was occasionally, because in one case, I was in that situation where you hear a bomb being dropped, the next one getting louder and louder and louder, and then the next one hit just about a quarter of a mile away. And then was silent, and I was on the sort of receiving end. You know, I was rather frightened that time.
Were you in a shelter?
No, I wasn't in a shelter. Most of the time we ignored the air raids at the beginning. You know, we just slept or did whatever.
Were you just in the house?
This one I was outside. We were in a sort of block of flats, the main street, and we were a square in the back of it, and there was a big sort of archway, and I thought if anything is safe, it's the archway.
So, were shelters available at that time?
They were building them, yes, very much so. They had fantastic shelters there.
In what way were they fantastic?
Towers, round towers, they're still standing, and the one in not far away from where I lived. And underground shelters, about those separate as well. But those towers have a pointed roof, you know, any bomb would glance and get thrown away. And the walls were, possibly a meter thick, reinforced concrete. And, you know, there was everything in it, like ventilation, oxygen, hospital, whatever, medical section. Rather big, and they took quite a few people in there. So the people used to get the little hand back and disappear in there.
How many people could they hold?
I'm not sure. I didn't. I never went into one of those shelters except in, what was it, in 43. That was on the Reeper Bahn in the big shelter there. That's in the amusement area of Hamburg, as you well know.
Why did you not go into them?
Well, it wasn't that, you know, dangerous we thought.
So you had the tower shelters and the underground shelters?
Yes.
What were the underground shelters like?
They were, well, dug out deep, arched covers over the top, and they were really good. There was steel doors, you know, prevented, all that kind of stuff. Really efficient shelters.
Would there be food and water supplies in these shelters?
No, they didn't keep that. There was water facilities there, yes, water for drinking, but no food or anything like that. Because I never reckoned to be any lengths of time in the shelter.
And toilets?
Yes, there was toilet facility. It was a sort of dry chemical. Chlor is, wasn't it?
Elsan toilets, we call them.
Yeah.
And so when you were sent to Poland, to this place, to Graudens,
yes.
Did you go as an individual or as a group?
No, as an individual. I arrived there and there was a few sort of German people there that were running the factory. The rest was all Polish people that had been working at the aircraft works there before, building Polish aircraft. And, well, I was rather a novice in that sort of game, getting people under me and, I guess, being in charge. But I used to come by and inspect the various items that were manufactured and that's right. And I was control for FWG4, the stamp I used to, metal stamps, everything was accepted by me. And then it went to assembly.
So you were inspecting for quality?
For quality, and of course design, comparison, and that's right. It had to be correct. And then later on, I was called back to the firm in 44, and I was then flight ready inspection, the last inspection before test flight, and I did that for a while.
Were there any problems with quality?
There was a few attempts at sabotage, obviously, but we usually found out. We had one fatal accident there with an aircraft. They had replaced the steel bolts on the wings with mild steel bolts in the shield.
Was that deliberate? Or?
Yes, it was deliberate.
So where did the accident occur?
At the airfield. We had an airfield at Graudens Aircraft Works, and quite a German, famous German flyer got killed there, Fokker Achilles.
As a result of this sabotage?
The sabotage, yes.
Did you see the accident?
I run across to where the aircraft was about a quarter of a mile away, and I still think I saw his arm move on the side of the plane. The engine had buried itself, and he was sort of, you know. And when they lifted him out, it was just like a sack of rubber, you know, nothing.
So, would it have been possible to tell whether the ball were they ball bearings?
No, but the big key bolt to put the wings on, you know, that one. Would so instead of being steel, it was mild steel.
Would it have been possible to tell whether it was steel or mild steel?
Well, this is one thing. We had a big investigation there, and we never found out, because all the those bolts, by the way, hadn't got a stamp on it. They weren't inspected. So they had been sort of brought in, possibly made outside. Not only were the mild steel, they were hollow. So once the load got onto that wing, that was it.
But should it have had the stamp on?
It should have had, but, you know, once the casing and everything is on, you don't see it. I couldn't see it at the flight ready inspection. I control the various elements of the ailerons and rudders and engine mountings and all that, but was visible at the flight ready.
So was the perpetrator discovered?
No.
Was that the only occasion when such a thing occurred?
Well, I had a later on in 44. I was by then adjusting the guns and the aircraft. I was an armourer and used to get the flight test after that. I used to take the aircraft down. I had a rolling license. I couldn't fly it, but I could roll it down to the shooting range, jack it up, anchor it, and adjust the guns and such like. And I had a couple of Russian heavies, we used to call Hilfsverlege volunteers. They were there, they were helping with the very thing. And we had a sort of right angle telescope which used to be slotted into the barrel. And you could look at the target, if you know what I mean, adjust your gun until it was lined up to the target. And for some reason, at one time, I came by and went back to it and couldn't get the barrel in, so I took it to bits. A coin had been put into the barrel, you know, at the end there, where the nozzle fits on. And we were using live ammunition, so it could have exploded.
Who had done that?
The two Russians disappeared after that. They were the only ones that were in that area. There was nobody else.
Were they found?
I don't know what happened, whether they actually found it, but, you know, the security service was there and inspected it.
What year would that have been, do you think?
44.
What were living conditions like at Groudon's for you?
Barracks. Barracks, bed bugs, a lot.
Why were conditions so bad?
Well, there had been Polish army centres. That was when I went on to leave Rüstung Luft, Rearmament Air, in July 44. Actually, I was in France at that time, and I got arrested twice because of I was on my way to Germany, and no German was supposed to be leaving.
Just before, can I get this clear?
Yes,
you were talking about the working conditions at Groudon.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Living conditions at Groudon,
yes.
Being poor.
Yeah.
Did you fall sick there then?
No, not sick, but we tried all kinds of things by putting the legs of the bed into cans of paraffin and such like. But then they used to drop from the ceiling down onto the bed.
What were relationships like with the Poles there?
I had good relationships there with most of them. Actually, in one case, while I was on my way down to the hangar, I was hit with a stone on my head and I started bleeding all over. Anyhow, the stone hit me on the head and I was on a bicycle, so I went to the nurse's centre and they shaved it and bandaged my head up. And a few days later, I got a letter of apology. I hadn't been the target.
Who had thrown it?
Poles. There used to be a big pile of crushed aircraft and they could hide in that lot, sort of.
Who had been the target, do you know?
I'm not sure, one of the other inspectors. And we had a working crew of British prisoners on the field there, they were in a camp at Graudenz, and I was very much impressed when they marched through the town. They used to be always very smart, the soldiers. And when I passed the camp, I used to whistle English tunes, sort of, you know, and try to get friendly with them. And I met one or two of them, and when I got my calling up papers, they actually wished me the best of British luck.
Did they have to do any work?
They were doing various things, just levelling the airfield or doing bits and pieces like that. They didn't do anything that was detrimental to the war.
When you talk about the Poles and the Germans in this area, was it clear who was a Pole and who was a German, or could you get a person who was sort of half Pole, half German?
Well, you had the Volksdeutsche, that means people of German descent, Volksdeutsche, and you had the Poles, which actually had been moved from other areas into that area after the Poles got that area.
But were the Volksdeutsche half German and half Polish?
Well, they were possibly Polish nationals, but their parents had been Germans, or their families had been Germans.
How long were you working at the factory at Graudenz?
Must have been about, I think, about a year in the first case and then about 4 months in the second case. The first case when I was transferred there, and then when I went back in 44, in June, July 44. I went to Erlauf Flugzeugwerke, that was in Leipzig, where I was adjusting the cannons on the Mi-262, the jet fighter. And then I was transferred from there back to my old firm in Graudenz.
So you had a period in Leipzig?
Leipzig and Dresden.
Between and Dresden, between?
Dresden, Klotze, Leipzig, Heiderblick.
In 1944?
Yeah.
And you were working on the Messerschmitt jet?
262, yeah.
Can you tell me about the work that you did in Saxony?
In Saxony, that was Sachsenmied. Now, at Dresden-Klotze, there was Messerschmitt 262s in a factory area which had been bombed. The aircraft had been bombed. So I made out a report what was required to reinstall the, you know, make them fit again on the various aircraft, took the numbers and then assessed the damage and by the books said what needs replacing in the truck, in which we could cannibalize off another aircraft for that one in the truck. So it was, must have been about 40 262s there which had been damaged by bomb splinters and the truck.
How much did you know at that time about jet aircraft?
Nothing. Nothing about it. I mean, this Heinkel and the Strike, we had no idea about that. I think it was kept pretty secret.
But did you know that you were dealing with a jet aircraft?
Oh, yes. Then, yes, we had seen, you know, the movie films, sort of the Lewis Report and the Fantastic Speed. At Leipzig, there was the Air Ministry. That's where I had to report. And from there, I was transferred to Leipzig, to Erlauf Flugzeugwerke. And from there to this area where we had the damaged aircraft.
And that was in Dresden?
Yeah.
What were the main problems you had in doing that job?
Well, I was still in the German Air Force uniform. I had no problems. I got rations, etc., good rations in those days. Because Rüstung Luft, we used to get extra meat and butter and such like.
So when did you join the German Air Force then?
In 42.
When you were transferred to Graudenz?
No, must have been earlier. I'll have to take my notes and see what I can come up with.
So you were like ground crew in the German Air Force?
Yes, I was admiral. Waffenbord,
an armourer?
Yes.
But was this an Air Force job that you were doing at Groudon's or a civilian job?
It was a civilian job, but they'd used my expertise as an armourer.
And when you first joined the German Air Force,
yes,
did you have military training at first?
We had military training in France.
When was that, in 42?
Is there a date on here?
So it sounds as though you joined the German Air Force in August 42.
Yeah.
And after you joined, you immediately went to France for...
We went to Berlin Schönwalde. That was a sort of grouping area where they were, and from there transferred to Cambrai and Douai in Low Countries in Belgium and France.
What kind of training did you get there?
The normal, what you would call square bashing.
Drill.
Drill, yes, drill. How to salute and how to walk.
How did you take to the discipline of the German Air Force?
Well, I wasn't very happy because we had instructors of the same rank as us. They were so-called, what was classified as Flieger, and they gave us orders, so I didn't like it very much.
Were you ever punished as an airman?
As an airman, yes. Well, that was actually an accident. As an armourer, I got some guns from the companies that were brought in, and I checked the rifle, and it still had a bullet into it, and it fired in the room where I was working. So,
what did you get for that?
I got confined to the quarters for
barracks.
Yeah, for barracks.
So, you were at Groudon's, then Saxony, and then back to Groudon's.
Yes. That was in the aircraft in 44 again, jumping from one to another.
But in coming back to 42, after you'd done the drill,
yes,
in Cambrai-Douai area,
yes,
where did you go then?
I went to Dresden, to the armoury training school. And we were instructed in disassembling, repairing, etc., weapons.
What was the quality of the training that you got there?
Excellent.
Did you work on a squadron?
No, this was a school.
But after this, did you
after
go to a squadron?
After that, I went to Berlin. To an airfield, and I was in the armory there.
Working on squadrons?
No, not on squadrons. We were servicing army rifles and machine guns, etc. The aircraft guns.
What were the main problems in doing that work?
Well, we had all the equipment there, so it was not very difficult, straightening barrels and that kind of stuff.
This was about, were there any air raids there?
No, not in that period.
And after that, after Döberitz?
Döberitz, I went to Dunkirk. I was transferred to the Air Force Field Division, went to, what was it first, that was Dunkirk, Bray Dunes, Strong Point Adolf, one of those fortifications there.
So you were acting like infantry?
Yes, we're acting like infantry.
Like what we call the RAF regiment?
Yes. Luftwaffenfelddivision, field division.
So you were on coastal defences?
Coastal defence at that time, yes.
Like a soldier?
Well, we did. I was armourer there, but at the same time we used to take patrol along the beach across the Belgian border to Strong Point Berta, which was on the other side of the border. Used to have big St. Bernard with us and an Alsatian. We had a radio with us in case we saw something.
Did you see anything?
No, didn't see anything. I used to sort of try and get England on it.
Why did you try to get England?
Well, a bit of fun, the sort of thing, the old thing, flat through Fuji, the fly, etc. You know, all the things that I had picked up, and the same thing on the radio we had on the Strong Point. We had various barracks and bunkers on there. You sometimes got either Germany calling or got the British broadcast for the jazz music.
For entertainment purposes?
For entertainment, yes. We weren't that interested in the politics of it. And we didn't believe any of the so-called, what they called propaganda in those days. But we used to like to listen to the wireless music.
Did you manage to get any of the music from England?
Oh, yes, many a time. I used to, as I said, I had a collection of records before the war. And we used to go to the American embassy for jam sessions.
And what kind of music were you receiving from England?
Well, Harry Roy and Nat Canella, etc., that kind of thing.
Dance band music.
Dance band music, yes. I remember the first thing I ever bought was a Donkey Serenade, an English record. But then I realized that the so-called hits of the period, the records were dead after a few months' time, while the English one kept their appeal. So I started a collection there.
What did the Air Force authorities think to you picking up BBC broadcasts?
Well, this was always when there was nobody there that politically would report or something like it. I mean, we always said, oh, we thought it was Bremen, you know, the Germans had Germany calling.
So nobody reported you?
No, we were all right there.
How did you like doing this job on the Channel coast?
Well, we had the Strong Point, serviced cannons and the guns. We had some Belgian First War cannons in bunkers there. Serviced them. We did some trial shootings. And, we had to build up defences. And I developed an idea there by making it possible for us, if anybody approached a Strong Point, that we would see them. I came by and got some oil drums, opened them out, painted them white, fixed firebombs, you know, those
incendiaries.
Fixed one of those on the inside to it, put a pull wire onto it and put trip wires along the beach.